For many species, spring brings with it a long journey north. We all watch for the birds that come early, but right now there is a full-on migratory rush hour. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we'll explore the wonders of the spring bird migration with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. Thrushes, orioles, grosbeaks, warblers, red-headed woodpeckers, and many others are making their appearances in Iowa right now. We'll find out how best to witness this migration, and we want to hear about the birds you're seeing. Jim will also answer your questions. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Many of us watch carefully for robins and other birds that indicate that winter is coming to an end, but the spring bird migration is pretty long, and right now, the sky is a busy place. This hour, we will explore the wonders of the spring bird migration with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. And I know it was a hardship for you to come in today because you wanted to stay and watch what was going on in your own backyard.
It's been hard to tear ourselves away from the windows. As a matter of fact, the last several days have been absolutely amazing. For those of our listeners out there who are watching birds, they've probably seen lots of ones that they're really excited to get back. You mentioned several in your introduction, the rose-breasted grosbeaks and the orioles. We have had, over the last 3 days, no fewer than 25 spring migrants appear in our yard and around our property. It's just been absolutely amazing. Now, some of them arrived earlier, things like red-winged blackbirds and the grackles certainly were here a month or more ago. Brown thrashers, catbirds arrived about a week ago or so. And certainly turkey vultures have been here for a couple of weeks anyway, and wood ducks have been on the nest for 2 weeks, so they arrived back in March. But lots of other things like the Swainson's thrushes, red-headed woodpeckers, Savannah sparrows, they're brand new. It's wonderful.
And so their mating season must be later than the other.
Yeah, exactly. And the seasons of all of these birds, and that's what's so fascinating to me, not just to see old friends that we've missed since last fall, but to think about the distances that some of these birds travel is just amazing, and seeing how they find their way. And that's one of the things I want to talk about today is how do they make this trip?
Well, and is there sort of a rule of thumb? Do the birds that arrive a little later, are they traveling from farther?
Often that is the case, although there's a difference between how far south the males of the species migrate versus the females.
Oh, interesting.
So red-winged blackbirds, for example, the males will be back. Oh, criminy, they've been back since mid-March, and they've been setting up territories and raiding bird feeders and all those things long before the females arrive, a month or more sometimes. And it's because the females migrate further south than the males do. And so the males come back first and kind of make sure everything's okay and set up their territories.
Right. Scare off all the joggers and the bicyclists that threaten their territory.
It sounds like you've experienced some of that.
A little bit.
So, yeah, it's really pretty amazing to see this. Now, the most colorful ones, certainly, that have shown up in the last few days, in particular here in central Iowa, and it depends where our listeners are in the state. Those in the southern part of the state, there are, and the way I keep track of this is through the Iowa Bird Line. There are people report their sightings there, and they get all excited when they have their first of the year Baltimore Oriole or Orchard Oriole show up. And these are two different species of Orioles. And so they reported on the bird line. So the people in the southern part of the state certainly get them earlier than those of us in the central. And some birds that we saw this weekend will be arriving in northern Iowa, by tomorrow or Thursday, probably. So it's really interesting to watch the progression of spring.
And, of course, we're not the destination for all of the birds that we see. I mean, as lovely as Iowa is in the summertime, they're not all just coming here, right?
Yeah, and that's one of the interesting things. So we saw last 2 days, we've seen very large flocks of Harris sparrows and white-crowned sparrows. Now, some of our listeners may have seen a couple of white crowns or maybe a Harris or two during the winter, but we're talking, 15, 20 birds in one group and probably many more than that scattered around the woods. And they are coming through from the south and will end up in the Arctic. They'll actually nest farther north in the Arctic. In fact, this morning I haven't noticed nearly as many Harris sparrows around as there were yesterday. This is a fairly large sparrow and has this beautiful sort of black hood and mask that goes down into a nice necklace, not a necklace, really, a black upper breast as well. A really, really beautiful little sparrow. And then the white-crowned sparrow is a fairly large sparrow, nests in the northern boreal forest and into the Arctic in Canada. And again, they're just coming through, and we won't see them again until fall.
And when they just pass through, about how long do you have to see them?
Oh, a few days at most. It depends on the weather, because birds are very dependent upon the weather. A few years ago, I remember doing a program with you where we had this amazing and very rare, what's called a fallout, where you have this migration really pushing north, and then all of a sudden they meet a huge cold front or a really bad storm system or something, and they literally, there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of northern birds that got stopped in one sort of area. We had hundreds of them in our yard and on our property, thousands of them, in fact. So the fallouts are pretty rare.
I can just imagine how the bird lines light up when that
happens. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It is truly an amazing phenomenon and very uncommon. But so it's really they depend on the weather to some extent. So if it's a really nice, if it had stayed the last 2 days instead of having the rain we've had, if we had had nice warm southern winds blowing north, they'd have been here for a day to feed, and most of them would be gone the next night. And this is something that people can actually watch on radar. This is how massive some of these migrations are. The NOAA website, the NOAA website, and you can go to the, I think it's just NOAA.gov, www.noaa.gov, and type in your zip code and go to the weather. And because many of these birds migrate at night, you want to look at this about somewhere around sundown, 7:30, 8 o'clock, 8:30, somewhere around there, and you will see the migration. The rain showers show up as greens and reds, and the migration shows up as sort of these deep blues, masses or even lines of birds heading north. It's really fascinating to watch.
So we have been asking this question, I think, since we first figured out that birds do this. But
right.
What do we know about how it's possible for birds to take these migrations and know where they're going and know how to get back and know when to start? And of course, many of the migrating birds, it's their first year out there. What do we know about how that works?
Yeah, it has fascinated people for thousands of years. People noticed it literally several thousand years ago, and we've been speculating and studying it ever since. it has been the, you know, there was a theory that Aristotle, actually, 3,000 years ago, noticed that some birds traveled to warm places to spend the winter. And he had a belief, in fact, that some birds like swallows actually hibernated to survive harsh winter weather instead of migrating. And that sort of idea persisted for about 2,000 years. So, but we finally been studying this enough that we know that that's not the case. Birds don't hibernate, but they do migrate. And how they do it is one of the most amazing things. And it depends on the species or group of species we're dealing with. Many of these birds, I mentioned just a minute ago that you can see on the NOAA website, at about sundown, you can see these sort of masses of migrants moving northward. The reason you see them at night is that many of these birds migrate at night, and they spend their day on the ground, just as the ones I were talking about earlier, the white-crowned sparrows and the harris sparrows, for example, feeding. They're trying to rejuvenate their energy, so they need some stopover places each day to stop. They'll rest a little bit, but mostly they're getting more food. They're not sleeping a whole lot, so they migrate at night. And you say, well, gee whiz, how do they migrate at night? What is it that they're following? Well, many birds have an internal compass. There is a thing in their brain that helps them orient themselves, and orientation means how do they determine compass directions. And there seems to be a magnetic field. They're able to detect the magnetic fields, the north-south longitudinal magnetic fields on the Earth. And so they'll follow those longitudinal lines. Daytime migrants, and there are many daytime migrants as well, tend to follow other things like topographic features on the landscape, mountain ranges, river systems. So we have the sort of the Mississippi flyway for ducks and geese. So they're following that tremendous Mississippi-Missouri complex river southward and northward. And so that's two of the ways. Another thought, which has been proven in some birds, particularly things like some of the doves and a few others, that they use stars, actually the orientation of stars to migrate. As these are fascinating experiments to take a look at and see how do they determine this.
Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about the spring bird migration this hour. With me, wildlife biologist Jim Pease. And, of course, you are welcome to join the conversation as well with the observations that you've been making, maybe in your own backyard or as you go out and about. You can call us 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa at iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the spring bird migration with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. And you're welcome to join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa at iowapublicradio.org. And we already have a number of questions coming in, Jim, so we'll do some questions and continue our conversation.
Sure.
This one's from Abby in Polk City. I counted 25 blue jays at my feeder last week, and then Saturday I counted 10. Now they're all gone. Do blue jays migrate, or what happened to them?
What's really fascinating is that migration is not just a north-south thing, and sometimes birds will, it's like any migration, be it mammals or salamanders or birds or whatever, they're migrating to resources. And so some migration is north-south because insect-eating birds, for example, have to go long ways south to find insects in the winter to sustain them. Other birds will migrate altitudinally. So there may be in mountain ranges in the west or the east even, there are migrations up and down the altitude to seek resources. So it's too severe at the high altitudes. in the wintertime, but they're back there in the summertime to breed. And still other birds migrate, and in this case, blue jays were probably, this is several family groups that have gathered together and are sort of pairing off, sharing some resources, and they probably, there's probably a local migration. Why, we had the same thing. We had about 15 of the blue jays, and now they seem to have in one group, and then they seem to have broken off into smaller groups of 2 to 3, and I think they're still pairing off and deciding who's with who for this breeding season. So it's quite, there's lots of different kinds of spring groupings that are going on.
And they might be back?
Yes, that's right.
There doesn't seem to be a hard and fast rule about what birds migrate and what birds don't migrate. What are the indicators that, tell us that a species is probably migratory?
Okay. If there are pretty exclusively either nectar eaters or insect eaters, they're going to go south. If they, for example, the swallows, all of the flycatchers, including ones that we saw this week, like the phoebe and the wood peewee, and some of the other Epidomex of flycatchers, they all went far south in order to survive. Things like ruby-throated hummingbirds as well, they all went to Central America and yes, they do fly on their own across the Gulf of Mexico.
Wow, so amazing.
These little tiny birds, it's just amazing to think about that kind of a flight for them. And it's exhausting for sure, but they make it. So they're exclusively a nectar, they're not exclusively a nectar eater, but their other food, their main protein source is not nectar, but is insects and spiders. And so again, they go far south for that. So sort of the rule of thumb is if they're insect or nectar dependent, they're going to go far south. Those that have more of a fruit or seed diet, some of those migrate, but many of them are able to stick around. Things like robins, who can exist on seeds, have learned to. They're more generalists, but they really depend on worms, those in the Swainson's thrushes that have shown up this week, and the hermit thrushes and wood thrushes soon, they have all, generally go south, but a few of them, the more general species like the robins, we've had some of those around all winter long.
Right, right.
Even though the ground's frozen, you know, they've switched to berries and do other things.
So, well, I think a lot of us want to just categorize birds by their diet, and there are a lot of birds that eat a lot of different things, even if, like with robins, primarily worms, but...
Right. Yeah. Oh, they'll switch to berries very, very quickly and are able to do that. Now, and we take a bird, we look at a bird that sticks around for the summer as well as the winter, a thing like the chickadees, for example. Chickadees tend to eat a lot of insects during the summer months. In fact, a lot of birds that persist on seeds and berries throughout much of the year, during the nesting season, they have to have a supply of insects, worms, grubs, in order to get the protein to their young that the protein need or that the young need to grow. They have to have high percentage of protein. And seeds just don't do it. And so they will switch in the summertime, chickadees, nuthatches, some of those birds that hang around through the winter months eating seeds, they switch to insect diets right now as they're working on nesting. So they need higher doses of protein than plants can provide them.
Well, let's get to the phones. A number of people have questions at 866-780-9100. And Linda in Des Moines has a question that's going to be hard to answer, but it's one a lot of people have been asking. Okay. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Hi.
Love your show.
Yeah,
hi,
thanks.
Both of you. What's the effect of this forest fire in Alberta and Saskatchewan on migrating species?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would suspect in the short run, or in the long run, there's probably no effect at all, except for the birds that may have nested in that area. Fortunately, the boreal forest, which is what that Alberta fire represents, and actually there's a fire in northern Minnesota in relatively small by comparison, but also in boreal forest area. So birds that nested in those specific areas, and there does seem to be some homing instinct in a lot of bird species, so they'll go back to that same area. But the boreal forest is large enough there that even though it's, last I heard, was 400,000 acres, you know, it's a huge, huge fire. The birds that nested there won't nest there this year, but they'll find other boreal forest around there to nest in. Now, on the short-term basis, the amount of smoke, for example, that was coming south may have had some temporary delay of some northern movement, although I didn't notice any. But it was more, I think the thing that may delay them were shift their navigation abilities a little bit. It was the strong north winds that actually brought that smoke south. Now, most birds migrate at anywhere from a few hundred feet to up to about 3,000 foot level. Certainly some geese and swans and a few ducks migrate at much higher altitudes. Up to, you know, there are some geese and swans that migrate over Himalayas and over 30,000 feet. So, you know, that's pretty rare, though. So the smoke, I don't know at what levels it came into the state, but it certainly was down to the ground. So I think many of the birds may have migrated above that smoke level.
Well, you were talking about birds traveling at night, and of course during the day they do need to rest and refuel.
Right.
What if they get up there and realize they can't land? Does that put them in jeopardy?
In northern Alberta, well, right. It seems like a huge amount, but you know, we're talking the boreal forest is quite huge and stretches clear across, you know, central clear across Canada, north of the prairies. It's pretty big, and the taiga and the boreal forest are sort of zones there that they can so they'll shift their area that they might nest in, but I'm certainly it has an effect on a few birds in that localized area, but as a species you have to think much broader than that. And
right. Yeah, and I'm sure there'll be many nests lost,
etc. Oh sure, some that, you know, there may have been some already nesting in it, or a few. Mm-hmm. And those nests would be lost, and often particularly if it burned through some of the wetlands there, a lot of ducks would already probably, some would be on nests already, and that far north, they had pretty early ice out, and so some ducks and geese may have to re-nest, but fortunately they do that.
All right. Linda, thank you so much for your call. Next up, we've got John on the line in Des Moines. Hi, John.
Well, good morning. So many birds, so little time.
Yeah, isn't that the truth? This work gets in the way.
Yes. I walk Red Feather Prairie up at Sayreville, and I've always had a difficult time identifying individual sparrows.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But the behavior that I saw the other day, just I was laughing. This little bird would skitter, I don't know, maybe 20 feet, 25 feet ahead of me. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, he would literally leap on the seed head of a dandelion, pull it down to the ground and eat a few, and then he would zip off ahead of me again, jump on another dandelion, and do the same thing. And I have never seen that before, and I'm hoping you can help me just by the behavior what he might have been.
Well, a lot of the sparrows do exactly that behavior. Savannah sparrows, Lincoln sparrows, both the migrating Harris sparrows and White crown sparrows were doing that in our yard. We have dandelions, by the way, and so they will literally, like you're right, they jump on those heads, kind of beat them down to the ground, or if it's laying over on its side, they'll sit there and peck against and get some of the seeds out of it. But a lot of the sparrows do that, so I can't tell you exactly what one it might be. But even little chipping sparrows, I've noticed them doing that in our yard as well. And they'll stick around for the summer, of course. So, it's hard to tell which one it is. So.
Yeah, I get the chippers, the white-crowned and the white-throated, all in my backyard at
sure.
the same time. And
oh, that's
they're
great.
They're just fun to watch.
They really are, yeah.
I'd never seen that before. So, okay, well, thank you.
You bet.
Wind was it down a little bit anyway.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call with your questions. And Peter's on the line next in West Des Moines. Hi, Peter.
Hi. My
yeah,
question
Peter.
Is
yeah.
in regard, my question is in regards to how climate change has affected the bird migration and the food sources for birds.
Yeah. And this is the $64 million question. It is, so far, it's hard to detect, although if you look at things like the earliest date of arrival, if you kept track, and we've done a program before about what's called phenology, and that's sort of the sequential happening of things in the natural environment. If you looked at the earliest flowering dates, ice out, flowering dates of lilacs in your yard, or when the scilla or the bloodroot blooms, we've been noticing earlier and earlier and earlier dates for many of those things. The bird migrations, because they're triggered by things that are not local, that are more day length related, they're not impacted by climate change, then those things are less changeable. And the bird migrations have not been affected quite so much, although some birds have hung around through the winter now and are overwintering farther north. And so what the impact is in the long run for whole suites of species, we're not sure. The more immediate impact certainly seems to be that are impacted by climate change are the availability of birds to when they migrate during migration to sit down and replenish their food supplies along the way. If we have large areas of drought or desertification that expands, that will certainly impact migrating birds in a much larger scale. So the short answer is there could be some devastating effects. And like most changes in the environment, those species that are generalists are much more likely to adapt than those species that are specialists.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's a huge question. We could do a whole program, and there are lots of master's and PhD theses on this very question. People are studying this, quite interested in it.
And we're going to find out a lot more in the coming years as well.
Yeah.
Peter, thanks a lot for your call.
You're welcome.
Next up, let's go to Vince on the line in Dubuque. Hi, Vince.
Hello. Well, I would like to find out a little bit more from your expert, and he certainly is, and thank you so much for having him on, about birds' memories. And here's the thing. I have, for quite a few years, had various kinds of birds that will fly to my hand and recognize me. An American robin would come back for 4 years, sit on my lap and eat mealworms out of my hand.
It's amazing.
And I'm saying for about 4 minutes or 3 minutes at a time, and was very discreet, if you catch my
sure.
my meaning.
Sure. Yeah.
About his manners. yeah, Yeah, and I now have black-capped chickadee that flies to my hand, and these birds have come, even after 3-4 months, have come back to me and immediately have known me and
sure.
come immediately to me. I have to think that we're talking about remarkable memory, and I'd like to have you comment a little bit about that.
That's a great question, and one that's beyond my knowledge base. An awful lot of behavior in birds, including migration behavior like we're talking about today, is a very strong genetic component that's sort of pre-programmed into them. Charity mentioned, asked the question earlier, well, how do they know, what direction to go? There seems to be some learning involved from older birds that have taken this route before, primarily related birds. But there's an awful lot that is just genetic. It's been sort of programmed into their genes that causes them to migrate north or wherever in the springtime and the opposite direction in the summertime. Individual behavior. There's certainly the bird brain is very complex and is just being, I think we're just beginning to understand some of the basics. But certainly learning is very possible in birds. We look at birds that use tools, things like crows, blue jays. Lots of birds will use tools to actually get at food. And the very fact that they would learn what you look like and recognize you doesn't surprise me, I guess, very much. So we'll come back to this.
Right,
this is great.
Right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the spring bird migration and a number of other bird-related
yeah,
things
right.
with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. And we were just talking before the break about a little bit that we know about bird intelligence. And you were just saying, it's very possible that a bird could learn to recognize a human. And we have seen that. We've seen studies both in crows and in pigeons that show that they
Absolutely.
Can identify
yeah.
human faces.
Yeah, exactly. And certainly, while there is training involved, the question is whether they recognize the individual or they recognize some person in that same position holding very still with food in their hand. So the question is whether they recognize the individual or they recognize
the behavior.
So it's the whole, you get back to this whole nature versus nurture, and so large things like we're going to migrate several thousand miles to overwinter or back north to breed in the spring. That is often genetically determined, and certainly their ability to navigate, the ability to determine when to leave either direction, is very genetic. But the specifics about, to orient themselves north, south, and find their way, but to navigate specifically, that may in fact be largely, to home in on the exact spot or the same area where they grew up. That's navigation, and that may in fact be more learned behavior than genetic. Which is a really interesting, there are lots of subtleties in this navigation. You say, well, that robin came back for 4 years, which is, one of the probably an average lifespan for a robin. It may be a little longer than that, but at any rate, that robin came back. That's certainly learned behavior. But if that robin migrated to southern Georgia, that migration route is probably partially learned, and certainly the time to leave and when to come back is genetic.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff.
Well, you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Audrey's on the line next in Mason City. Hi, Audrey.
Yes, good morning, Charity and Jim, and happy birding to you both.
Yes, thank you.
What's your question?
Well, I'm wondering about the best way to bring the most diverse amount of species to my yard. Currently, we have 3 seed feeders, 2 suet stations, 2 hummingbird feeders, and 3 bird baths.
Good.
And I've seen like the dried millworms, and I wondered about adding those, if that would bring any difference in species to our yard or anything else that we could do to just bring in extra color and a little bit more to the community.
Oh, that's a great question, and certainly one that's valuable this time of year when you're thinking about planting things. And it's all about not just the kinds of food sources that you provide in terms of feeders or water sources in terms of bird bath, although that will help. Certainly the different kinds of food you provide at different levels. Some birds, as you well know, will feed on the ground and will almost never go up in a feeder, whereas others can feed, on vertical things. You put different kinds of feeders at different levels with different feed in them, you're going to attract a greater variety of birds. Same thing with water. If you have some water that is moving with a fountain, that will attract some, where still water will attract others. Some will come just to the water and not to the feed. So variety in those kinds of placements and the different kinds of feed and water you'd have out there will help. The basic thing, though, certainly is habitat, and having a variety of habitat in your yard, where some birds that like more open country birds, if you're trying to attract things like redpolls in the winter or prairie birds in the summer, having a more open area is going to attract them, depending on the size of your yard, versus many birds like to have a shrubby cover nearby other birds like tall trees. So the greater the variety you can in both the habitat and the food supply, if you plant things that lengthen the food supply out over through the breeding season and into the fall of the year, excuse me, you're going to have a greater variety of birds as well.
Can you give any suggestions on what to plant? Next summer, we're going to completely tear out our gardening area, like all of our flower beds. And I'd like to know, what's the best thing to plant there?
Yeah, there's actually a publication online that talks about the specifics of some of this. If you go to the ISU, Iowa State University Extension store, you can download a PDF for a publication. I've forgotten what the number is now. It's been too long since I've been out of Extension, but it's inviting birds to your yard, and there are a number of publications online as well that you can get that. Specifics for our area, I would plant a variety of shrubs, include some that have persistent fruit, that stays on the shrub well into the fall or even into the winter. Things like the viburnums, the highbush cranberry, some of the dogwoods, all of those have fruit that stays on, is persistent on the shrub, so it maintains fruit into the winter months. Whereas you also want to have some preferred shrubs with fruit that is preferred to be eaten right away, the choke cherries, the service berries, a lot of those, raspberries, that sort of thing. They all have very highly preferred fruit that birds will eat right away. So you want some of both in order to spread out that food supply for the birds. And a lot of publications will tell you specifics. What you need to do is make sure that they're, A, native to Iowa as much as possible, and B, that they will grow and be okay in northern Iowa, which is a different climate than southern Iowa, for example. So you want them to be able to survive the vagaries of our weather.
Now, I was going to ask you, and I think this is a great question. Not all of us have these backyards that are just teeming
right.
with birds.
Right.
So where do you go to see them if you don't have a backyard like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, fortunately in Iowa, we have lots of county conservation boards. Every county in the state has a county conservation board, and those counties' boards manage the parks in your area. And we are very fortunate in Iowa to have they're often small. You can go and for example, here in Story County, we manage about 3,500 acres of parks just on the county level. We don't have any state parks here in the county, but we've got lots of county parks. In addition to city parks and recreation areas, some city parks increasingly have wild areas or wild parks that are part of their suite of parks in an area. So you want to look at those park areas as well. If you don't have them, but you have to get outside
right.
and get out and walk or run.
What's
as you
the best
do,
time so. Of day?
Best time of day is often in the early morning or in the late afternoon. But early morning is always the best, and I'd say from sun up until about 10:30, maybe 11 o'clock, and then later in the afternoon towards evening is also a good time. You'll get a lot of birds that feed right before they go to roost overnight.
Now here's a question from Larry in Alden. One, he has two questions. One, I often see small birds, sparrows maybe, on my pickup tires and in the wheel well pecking or picking at something.
Yeah.
What are they doing?
Yeah, he probably has house sparrows or house finches. They both tend to, those are both not originally native to Iowa. House finches are native to the U.S., but they were native to the western U.S. and now have spread because they got released in New York City in 1948 and have spread all across the eastern part of the country now. So house finches and house sparrows, of course, are also known as English sparrows, are European. And they both have adapted very, very well to human habitation, and they tend to hang around houses and cars and that sort of thing. They're probably picking some seeds, maybe some grasses, and maybe even some salt off of his truck. And they'll often roost up on the top of the tires or actually on the frame of the truck overnight.
Well, and Larry has a really popular truck because his next question is this. He wants to know which robin gender builds the nest, male or female, because, he says, I have a robin determined to build its nest on top of my left front pickup tire.
Oh, yeah.
I hate to keep discouraging it, but the bird must be frustrated. The nest base keeps disappearing and reappearing, and with the latest nest effort laying on the ground.
He needs to drive more often.
I think so.
Right. Yeah, it's usually the female that will build the nest. Actually defend the site. And I've had them nest close to windows, and they will see the reflection in the window, and both the male and the female will attack that window, attack the reflection
right.
in the window. So he's probably got a female with a very strong nesting capacity and is not easily discouraged.
Hopefully she'll try another place.
Yeah. Maybe change the location of the truck. Move it over to the other side of the street or something.
All right. Here's a question from Phil. My wife and I recently saw a very unusual bird at our bird feeder, black and white with a large amount of white on the back, a reddish breast. It looked a little like a woodpecker, except the beak was totally not like a woodpecker's beak. Overall, the size was a little smaller than an adult cardinal.
Mm, sounds like a rose-breasted grosbeak. This is a wonderful bird. It's just arrived at our place in the last 3 or 4 days. And it is here during the summer and migrates clear to Central America and Northern South America during the the winter months has come all the way, and you can hear the Spanish accent in their in their song. But they'll be with us all summer, and has a very large beak, usually sort of whitish in color, and that rose breast varies from a light pink to a very intense rosy color. So you can actually sort of tell by both the pattern and the intensity of it. You can sort of identify individuals. We've been able to do that with three or four we've had in the last several days.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Judy's on the line in Cedar Falls. Hi, Judy.
Hi. My question is, I live on a small hill above the Cedar River. Last year, and I can't remember whether it was about this time, maybe a little deeper into spring, coming home at about 7 or 8 o'clock, seeing in the dead trees that are down by the river these huge blackbirds, and it wasn't until I walked a little closer that I noticed they weren't blackbirds because they had a hooked beak. And there were two on a limb. They seemed to have their own places where they would fly a little bit and then go back to those exact same limbs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those were turkey vultures, I found out.
Right.
And tell me about them. Do they migrate? Do they stay in Iowa all winter?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, we have turkey vultures around, and we seem to have increasing numbers of them. They have done very, very well with the changes that humans bring to the landscape. These are scavenger birds, and will scavenge on lots of roadkill and dead pig carcasses and lots of other things. They're amazing to watch because they have these very large wings. And they can float with almost no flapping at all. They may need to flap a little bit to get airborne, but once they get airborne, it's almost effortless to watch them as they their wings are off the horizontal, sort of up in a V for vulture, and they're doing very well. They do migrate to the south, as far south as Central and South America. Northern South America, and then come back north. Most of the birds we see in Iowa probably haven't gone quite that far south. They probably have gone to the southern U.S. along the Gulf Coast, some into Mexico. But there are turkey vultures all the way into northern South America. So
go ahead.
Yeah, that's all right. Go ahead.
That while there are always a lot of ducks and geese out in the Cedar River around where I live, and that was the quietest night I had ever seen. The birds were out on the river, not moving, and usually they're up on the grass and, foraging, but they were not moving. And the vultures would fly down close to where they were out in the water, but of course they didn't go out in the water.
Right.
But are other birds, are they birds of prey?
No.
Would they get a duck?
They would not. They would eat a dead duck. And what the birds may have been doing is just recognizing the sort of the shadow of a very large bird, thinking it was a raptor or a meat-eating bird that would prey on them. And so they pause momentarily. Turkey vultures they have communal roosts in the summertime. They usually nest in cliffs along some of our rivers. So most of the ones you see in cities and towns and on roosts like that along the Cedar River are non-breeding pairs that are waiting to be mature enough to find a mate and maybe find a place to nest. But they're fascinating to watch. They'll dry their wings, warm themselves up in the morning, and take off with the thermals in the early morning.
Well, I love to see them out in the sunshine in the morning when they stretch
great.
Out their wings
yeah.
and get warmed up and ready to go for the day. They're really cool. And we are out of time. Jim Peace, how much longer do we have to watch migrating birds?
Oh, you have several weeks yet. I would say 2 to 3, maybe. There may be some migrants that are still coming in. But get out there and see it now while it's going on.
All right, Jim Pease, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease will be back next month as we talk about Iowa's wild creatures and wild places. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.